Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Coffee and Open Source. We're going to have a great time today. We're going to chat with some really, really interesting person, and we're going to learn all sorts of great stuff about what they're doing in the open source community. I got my coffee, so let's go ahead and get started. My guest today, I'm very excited, is Mark Collier. Say hello, Mark. Awesome. Thank you for being here. So, Mark, do you want to give the audience a little bit of information more about you and kind of what excites you about open source?
My career, the most, last 10, 12 years or so, really focused 100% on open source. Happy to be able to talk about it here on the Twitch stream. And hopefully, if we do have any audio issues, we can work those out. We're doing this through many different tools that we're chaining together.
So it's some background. So one thing that always happens on any live stream is that everything sounds great. I do a recording, and then the second, it's basically a matter of having like one button checked. And like if the button isn't checked or if it gets checked out of order for whatever reason, it just doesn't work. But we're getting confirmation that things are good now. So hopefully we should be good with everything. And absolutely worst case, if the recording has issues, I can't actually download the recording from Twitch and then re-encode it using Premiere and Audition, and it should be good. So let's actually get to what we wanted to talk about, right? So open source, right? So you mentioned that you worked at a handful of different places, and I'm guessing at some of your previous employers, open source was a thing that was very important, maybe in other situations wasn't as important. At what point in time did you realize that this open source thing is important and something that I actually want to spend a considerable amount of effort getting to know better and building it as a part of your community?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so for me, I think that the kind of chain of events in my career that led me to really just having this aha moment and realizing how important open source was and why I wanted to really kind of focus on it personally in my career and the way I spent my time. It really kind of started when I was early in my career. I was doing product management. I started off as like a very technical kind of roles, and then I went into product management and started to learn more about the business side of building tech products, etc. And then I got more into the software business. Long story short, I discovered business development. And what I love about that as a role, and Steve Raymond is one of the folks that I consider a mentor who introduced me to the world of business development. And basically, what I learned about the power of that kind of activity is you can bring two companies together and really build something that's more valuable than either one company could build on their own. So that kind of introduced me to the power of ecosystems. And then when I was at Yahoo, I worked with Steve at Music Match. We got bought by Yahoo. When I was at Yahoo, working on these different types of partnerships and building ecosystems and figuring out how to create more value by bringing two or three companies together, there was a person I worked with there named Ian Rogers, and he has had a really interesting career and done a lot of different things. But one of the things he did is he introduced me to open source and WordPress, and he introduced me to Matt Mullenweg, the founder of WordPress. And so at that time, WordPress was getting traction. It wasn't where it is today, but it was obviously like an early open source hit, LampStack, all that. So Ian kind of introduced me to Matt, and Matt kind of showed me, the power of open source. And so I kind of got hooked on this idea. And what I realized is that when you think about the power of ecosystems to bring people across companies, across countries together, open source was like business development on steroids, just kind of an order of magnitude force multiplier. So to me, my mind was just like, wow, this is crazy. Like you could create so much value if you can get the companies to kind of put aside their egos just for a little bit for a specific, activity.
Just a small amount of time.
Yeah. Around one common platform they wanted to build, you could create so much more economic opportunity, so much more, just massive amounts more. So I kind of came up from a sort of capitalist perspective. I have an economics degree, which is not the way a lot of people come to open source historically. Maybe it's different. So I had kind of a tech childhood and then an economics college. And then, as a capitalist, I'm still a capitalist, but I know it's kind of a dirty word these days, but I just saw the power of people to kind of have more opportunity for everyone economically. And that's when I got hooked and ended up at Rackspace and kind of, helped start OpenStack.
Yeah, that's awesome. One of the things that you said that it just kind of turned a light bulb on for me is you mentioned that basically open source is business development on steroids, right? Like, mm-hmm. And I think, you know, something that's very top of mind for me when I talk with a lot of people on the stream or in general, it doesn't take very much to take an open source concept and turn it into this monster business, right? Like you look at Docker and Kubernetes, right? Mm-hmm. Like these open source concepts, you know, they were created by companies to kind of facilitate some of the things they were doing internally. They open source, mm-hmm. and now it's like the de facto standard for everything. You bring up WordPress and Lampstack, right? Who knows if PHP is where it is today if WordPress wasn't there, right? You know, who knows? Like PHP might have a presence still, but it might not be, you know, one of the top used languages on the planet, right?
Yeah.
It's one of those things where I think that if you have a good idea and you tie it to something open source related, it's one of those things that, you know, not to quote a movie, but, you know, if they build it, they will come, right? Like, it's one of those things that I think it's very, very interesting is it doesn't really take much effort if your idea is good and you're using open source, right? I think that was kind of what I gathered from what you were saying, which I think is pretty spot on.
Yeah, what I think is really cool is that you could ask, you know, did the Lampstack make WordPress successful or did WordPress make the Lampstack successful? And the answer is yes and yes and yes. You know, that's the beauty of it is they're all self-reinforcing. And what's so cool about open source, and we've definitely seen this with OpenStack, is people use it in ways you absolutely did not expect. So that's one of the great things about it is you put it in more people's hands and other have ideas, other problems to solve. They're addressing other markets that you had no clue they were going to use it for. And that unlocks sort of like you know, the exact opposite of the top-down hierarchical central planning method that you might associate with like central planning companies or even just one big giant company, you know, like Microsoft, right? Like that everything was kind of much more top-down. And now Microsoft's one of the biggest contributors of open source and embracing that around. And I think that shows you that the power of open source is greater for companies that they embrace it and
then
fight it.
No, I totally agree. And I don't like talking a ton about Microsoft on this stream because I'm very biased. But I think one of the things that's very clear is if a company, regardless of size, adopts open source, even if it's not just to get PR or to, you know, to sway public opinion, but even just bring it in internally to the things that you're building, right? Mm-hmm. You know, there's the very cliche phrase saying on the shores of giants, right? Where it's if you invest in open source technologies as a development team, your teams are going to be substantially more agile and efficient, right? Because reinventing mm-hmm. the wheel is hard every single time. So, you know, if you can take advantage of all of the people that do all the great work with NPM packages or all the people that do great work with GitHub repositories or what have you, right? Like, you have this opportunity to focus on what matters for your business instead of what matters from a technological perspective. And open source is a catalyst for that. And people that don't embrace open source from a business standpoint, I always ask, well, why? Is it a matter of you're concerned about IP? Is it a matter of you have just general thoughts about sharing your code with people? But I've always wondered, like, why people don't like open source. I don't know if you had any thoughts, if there are any particular scenarios that come to your brain of people you've run into that don't like open source and they had a good reason for it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's changed dramatically, you know, from OpenStack now, which is the most focused open source activity. I've been involved in terms of like dedicated time in my career, but you know, it's been 10 years now, almost 11 since we started OpenStack, and you know, in that decade, I mean, it's a completely different shift. You know, I think I saw a stat recently that 99% of code bases now have some open source in them. So I think it's hard to find anybody out there who's writing software who's just like completely kept open source out because it's too rich of a source of commonly solved problems. You know, because these problems are ones in which everybody has, right? So. And there's just too many good options out there. I think where people do get burned with open source in terms of not knowing exactly the best way to engage. And so if you just kind of, you mentioned NPM, right? Like there's, you can grab a bunch of packages off the internet, off of, you know, central repository, and, you know, and then get yourself in trouble, because in 6 months, in a year, I mean, certainly there's going to be things that need to be patched. And so, you know, especially with the attack surface out there of all the internet, everything being connected. So from a security standpoint, or I would say, to give you maybe a slightly different example, where we've seen companies kind of approach open source in a way that has burned them, is that as oftentimes what they do is they'll be kind of drawn to the fact that they can customize the source code. I've got it, I can make it do whatever I want. And that can be kind of like a blessing and a curse, because what happens if you're on a rapidly changing code base that's delivering this constant innovation through an upstream community, but you kind of fork off to the side and you make a few changes kind of just for your use case, and you don't contribute that upstream, you don't engage with the upstream community, you're just like, well, I was missing this feature I needed, so I have it, I carry these patches or whatever. Well, what happens is that over time, you actually get very costly in sort of, you know, money and time and effort and just cognitive load to get back onto the, you know, the upstream code base. And so you're kind of stuck on this older version. And, you know, so that quick win that you were kind of lulled into going, oh, well, okay, we're not going to contribute this upstream. We're not going to wait for it to come. You know, we're not going to engage upstream. So we're just going to kind of fork it and do our own patch. That can really burn you, because then, you know, 2 or 3 years down the road, you're on an old version, and it's just like, wow, it was a short term win, long term pain. And so that's, you know, that may be kind of a tangent from your question, but I think it's part of where open source can go wrong if you just kind of don't understand the pros and cons and just the nature of communities. Like, if you're not part of the community in any way, that can be an issue for you eventually.
Yeah, I think, you know, and another thing that you brought up, that you hinted at a little bit, that made me think. So I've had the pleasure of interviewing some folks on the stream that their previous lives, they were attorneys, right?
Uh-huh.
So, like, the whole concept of licensing is very confusing for folks, right? And if, you know, and if you don't get the licensing right, and you're using an open source package, and the licensing for that package changes, or you breach that license, it's a problem, right? Obviously, the larger the company, the less of a problem, right? I mean, you can throw lawyers at a problem, but if you're a small company, or you're just using open source packages incorrectly, and you go down this path, and then you get a nicely worded email saying, like, oh, you're using this package, you are in breach of this license for whatever reason, like, you're commercializing it or whatever, right? You know, that's something that can also scare people off. I think that's probably less so than just the fear of, like, the constant change that is open source.
Mm-hmm.
But from my experience, like, if you put developers in a position where they get to constantly innovate, I'm not saying this for all developers, but most of the developers that I know, if you give them the opportunity to learn new things and have fun, they're willing to put in a little bit extra to, you know, whether it be learning, you know, the ins and outs of a particular technology, getting an understanding of what open source code base is doing. Like, they'll make those perform those initiatives, right? Because they're enjoying themselves. For the most part, at least in my experience, like, we're all just a group of tinkerers. Like,
yes.
You know, I mean, I always have, like, I ask people a lot too, like, did you take apart remote control cars or the VCR or whatever when you were growing up? And most people say, yeah, or they got the computer and they got the computer books in the mail and things like that. So I guess my point is, if you give people the opportunity to learn and have fun, like, they're going to do more than you expect them to do as it pertains to, you know, learning. And that, like I said, that's not everybody, but I know me personally, the amount of time, the amount of hours I've wasted trying to learn something new, and I enjoy every bit of it. I mean, it depends on what the outcome is, right? If you're hacking at something for a while and you're like, this is not going to work, I mean, maybe it's a waste. But you learn that, okay, well, maybe, you know, what did you miss along the way? It's a learning experience as to be more insightful as it pertains to, oh, this might be a problem, I should probably look into this problem instead of continuing to rabbit hole on it, right? So it is a learning experience, even if it's a negative one.
Yeah, I think you hit on probably one of the most important reasons why open source has become this incredible game changer and become much more important inside of these different companies, and everyone suddenly needs an open source strategy. And what I mean by that specifically is that, you know, Mark Andreessen said many years ago, software's eating the world, and so people have seen this is coming true, and so more and more companies need software developers. So if you talk to companies out there, almost any company out there, hiring, sourcing talent is like one of the top, if not the number one challenge they have. So if you're going out in the market and you're saying, I need to attract talent for my company to be competitive, and then the talent pool out there is saying, I like open source, it's more fun. One of the reasons it's more fun is you can work, people that like to solve problems, you know, solve a puzzle, kind of that mindset, that tinkering mindset, they're more intellectually drawn to being able to just talk to other people doing similar problem solving. And guess what? You know, no matter what company you have, there are more smart engineers outside of your company than inside your company. It's a big world. So if the people that like to solve these problems that you need to attract inside your company to be successful are drawn to doing that work style through open source, then you better have an open source strategy or you're not going to attract the talent. So that kind of actually is one of the biggest, I would say, kind of root causes of why open source is becoming just much more dominant, is the people who you need to hire like it. It's more fun. So, you know, and hopefully we're making corporate America slightly more fun every day and a little less of a drag.
Yeah, I can't remember what I was reading, but it was talking about how, especially now in the last year with the pandemic changing a lot of things to digitally first, right? You're watching all these companies kind of be forced into stepping forward like 4 or 5 years as it pertains to like how they do their business. Like we were talking about this a little bit before we got started. Like I work in the event space at Microsoft. Like that's not all I do, but I do a lot of stuff that, you know, regarding our, you know, our top tier events, the builds and ignites. You know, when we had to go from in person to digital, I think, you know, the head of our events organization at Microsoft said, well, we had to fast forward in 2 years in 2 months, right? Yeah. You know, going from this huge, you know, renting out a venue in Las Vegas and having, you know, 40,000 people hanging out with you to completely digital experience that's not boring. Like it's super. And I think Microsoft was one of the first companies to actually had to do an online event. Because we had a big event.
I followed that closely, actually.
Yeah. It's one of those things where, like, we couldn't cancel, like, the biggest Microsoft event of the year, and it just happened to come, like, 2 months after the entire world shut down. And, you know, I know a lot of eyes were on Microsoft, and I think we did pretty good, but, like, even now, we had these conversations internally about, are we doing this the right way? Are we captivating audiences? Do the audiences want a session that's this long versus a session that's this long? Like it, and we are having a joking conversation earlier about it being like a TV production, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Like,
and it's very, very funny because all these other and we're in tech and we're struggling, right? I can only imagine the companies of the world that, you know, their area of focus is nowhere near technology. Sure, they have an e-commerce page and maybe they have some technical marketing, maybe they do social media, but like, the core of their business doesn't depend on people going to a website to interact with them, whether it's a store or a restaurant or whatever, right? And the reason why I'm going off on this tangent is to come back to your point about the need for technically skilled people in the market is absurd right now. I was listening to an interview about how, you know, I think there's a gap of 5 million jobs in tech that need to be hired that there's nobody for. And, you know, the goal is to get these people, find people to, you know, fill these roles. So we're talking about training and initiatives to get people to be ready to enter the workforce. And one of the things that I always think about is that it's a very hard sell, other than the money, to be a technologist. Because it's constant questioning of what you're doing, if it's the right thing or not. Like, just think of the developer loop, right? You fail 100,000 times a day. So the resiliency to be able to continue to work in that capacity is very hard, and nobody tells you that, right? And I think one of the things that I think is very important is that if you can leverage community to help you, like whether it be open source or Stack Overflow or whatever, it's going to make it less daunting. And I couldn't imagine being a developer 20, 30 years ago without any of these resources, right? It's very challenging.
Sorry to interrupt, but I just...
No, of course. I was done.
There was a Twitter thread, and I'll have to go back and find it, just like a few days ago, talking about how that when we tell, just kind of generally go out and say, anybody can be a coder, like become a coder, like you can do it too, that like, that's sort of a blessing and a curse in the sense that, you know, yes, like if you, it isn't something that you couldn't learn if you really apply yourself, and the tools are more accessible than ever. And there's all kinds of free online learning tools and open source is a massive enabler, all these sort of positive optimistic things. But, but the other side of that is let's not set the expectation that it's easy. Because if we set that expectation, then people will quickly get discouraged because guess what? It's not easy. You know, nothing really, no valuable skill out there is going to be easy to learn. So the fact that you can do it is good, and you should feel like, you know, that it's a field that has a lot of opportunity. There's certainly massive economic opportunity, but also be prepared to sort of fail over and over and over again, maybe more so than any other sort of a skill you try to learn. I don't know if, you know, it's not a competition for which skill is the hardest, but it's certainly not something that you're just going to trivially fall into and like, oh, everybody says I can code. Well, yeah, I mean, you can.
Yeah.
I do think that most people can if they have access to, you know, the online tools and have the time. It definitely takes, it takes time that not everybody has depending on their situation. So it has a massive leveling effect of helping to uplift people that maybe haven't had economic opportunity. So I'm an optimist about it, but I think we shouldn't, you know, it could backfire, I guess, is sort of the point that people feel like, well, I guess it's not for me because I tried a couple of tutorials and I failed. It's like, okay, well, that's actually going exactly as expected.
Yeah, exactly. That's completely spot on. I had a friend of mine that wasn't in tech, but they were, I hate saying they were like using the phrase nerdy, but they very much like nerd things, right? Which is totally cool. You can be nerdy and not be interested in tech, but for whatever reason, they wanted to get into tech. And they said, well, what's it like to be a developer? I'm like, well, do you like snapping yourself with a rubber band? And the answer was, well, no, why would, like, that's all day. And it was a tongue-in-cheek comment about how, like, but I was like, it's one of those things where you just have to be okay with a little bit of pain constantly. And I love my job. I love what I do. I wouldn't trade. I knew the second I wrote my first HTML web page on Shelby Mustangs when I was a sophomore in high school, this was my thing. But, you know, a lot of people, they get introduced to tech. And the money, the concept of the money is just so good comparatively to, you know, the median amount of money that you can make doing other jobs. Mm-hmm. And people are very much like, they kind of just put the blinders on for the money. And it becomes this thing where people put up with something they're not happy doing because the money is good. And, you know, as we try to find and fill these roles, we want to kind of try to avoid people that could potentially lead to attrition, right? Like, there's companies out there that are very well known for, oh, you work this job for 2 years and then you get out because your life gets crushed, right? Like, is it the reason why that is because the job's too hard, or is it because they're bringing in people that, you know, don't want to do the job long term, right? That's the question, right? Is technology isn't for everybody, and this is getting kind of morbid, right? But technology isn't for everybody, but at the same time, if you are drawn to it, more than likely you're going to be prosperous in it. And I don't know if that made any sense to anybody, but I guess...
I guess I would say, you know, I wouldn't presuppose to tell people whether, you know, why they should or shouldn't get involved in technology. If they want to get involved just for the money, go for it. I have sure. No problem with that whatsoever. So, you know, everybody has a different life circumstance, and it may be that this, you know, even if it's not your the thing you want to be doing every day, ideally. It could be your ticket out of a much worse economic situation. Yeah. So, everybody's got a different situation. And for some people, like, that's more than enough reason. But for other people, like, maybe there are other paths. But I do think, technology is in some ways kind of inescapably going to be part of your career. If you want to have an Etsy store because of your craft, well, that's you're going to probably have to know something about that, how to get customers. So, some technology background is probably going to be relevant to you no matter what business you're in and what your passions are. So, in that sense, even if you end up kind of not being a coder per se, but being involved in other ways, like it is still just a massive economic opportunity kind of engine for people. So hopefully that can be more of a leveler for access to that economic opportunity. I know I'm kind of a broken record on that, but that's kind of what gets me excited about the power of it all.
I mean, that's totally fair though, right? Like, and to be blunt, I think technology has done some great things for me, probably done some great things for you too, right?
Definitely,
and I think one of the things that I try to tell people that want to get involved in tech, because I'm a bit of a pessimist by nature, and I tend to really gravitate towards like what's hard about the job. But whenever I do talk about what's good about the job, I get very excited because, I think you and I are probably cut of the same cloth where it's, we love talking about stuff. We love talking about the things that excite us, right? We're passionate folk.
Yeah.
And I think, yeah, exactly, right? And that's very contagious. You have a conversation with somebody who isn't in tech, and you can spend 75, 80% of the time talking about how miserable you are, but that 20% of you talking about, that moment where you turn over and, like, you have something that hasn't worked for 2 or 3 days and now all of a sudden it works, like, that is, at least to me, better than any other mind-altering substance, period, right? That feeling of success, and I know a lot of people probably don't feel that way, but that's how I feel. And that is very alluring to people. So when I talk with people that aren't in tech and I tell them, like, pick things that have interest to you. Like, don't go to some website and do, like, the Hello World example, because you'll get bored, right? Try to figure out a situation where you could probably build something or think about building something that is actually tangible. Because then once you get, I guess, committed to something, you get far more satisfaction from the completion of that thing. And being in open source, as you well know, nothing is ever done. So it's just about building on top of something that you counted as done at some point in the past.
Yeah, I think that sort of like intellectual curiosity to me is one of the most powerful forces that can get you through the dark times of the learning curve. And so what are those things you're most intellectually curious about, and sort of like use that as the topic, if you will, of pursuit in terms of what you're trying to learn, and in some way involve that in your journey of learning, because I think that will keep you going when you hit these roadblocks. Because as you said, a few times, like, anybody who's learning technology, specifically, software development, is going to be constantly running into bugs they don't understand and code that they wrote or someone else wrote, and that's just an everyday occurrence. And so if there's something inherent in the way you're applying that technology for whatever purpose that you're just personally interested in or intellectually curious in, it will probably help you kind of push past that point, because everybody hits that sometimes several times a day where you just don't understand. And but if you're naturally kind of like curious about why something's broken, and you're almost obsessive about trying to fix it, then technology may be right for you, because everything is broken all the time. You're gonna have a lot of never-ending work if that's the type of thing that motivates you.
And one thing that I've been very fortunate to have this in my life is that you'll never run out of friends if you're the guy who knows how to fix stuff with computers, right?
Yeah.
That's a joke. I can't say on people asking me for help with computers. But anyway, one of the things I wanted to chat with you about as well is that, so when I think of open source, you know, obviously the de facto thing when people think of open source these days for a developer standpoint is like GitHub, right? But GitHub is very focused towards developers. And, you know, as I went through the process of kind of getting to know your body of work a bit more, like, obviously you have built things that cater to developers, but you've also built a lot of things that are catered to IT professionals, right? This idea of open infrastructure. And, you know, I wanted to kind of get your thoughts as something like why, or not why, but tell me why open or infrastructure is a commodity, has been something that's been so an area of passion for you.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the reason is that if you look at the problems that humanity is trying to solve, you know, whether it's climate science. I mean, there's like frozen trees and snow in my backyard, and I live in Texas, so that's kind of a sure. head scratcher. Maybe there's an area we need to solve for, but any problem that we're trying to solve, you need access to compute, storage, and networking. You need access to that sort of raw infrastructure in some way, shape, or form. Whether you're doing, you know, physics modeling at CERN, they have the Large Hadron Collider. They have hundreds of thousands of compute cores. So there's numerous examples, but increasingly humanity's problem solving and, you know, science, whatever, commerce, it all relies on access to these tools. And so for me, you know, I fundamentally believe everyone in the world should have access to those tools. I think that open source infrastructure, you know, utilizing open source to create the tools that then people can operate for, so cloud infrastructure, edge computing, all these different examples, like that helps distribute access to the tools that human beings need to solve problems and have economic opportunity. So to me, there's kind of a moral imperative. I mean, just a practical economic imperative that we build and make available freely the tools of the trade, if you will, the tools of problem solving. And so for me, you know, part of it is just competition. You know, you want to have, I want the world personally to have a lot of different options when it comes to getting access to that. If there was one company and it was a monopoly, and that was the only company that was in the world where you could get those tools that you needed to do, you know, let's say research for science, like, to me, that would be not a great outcome. You know, it's better than not having any access, but like the more we can give distributed access to those tools in terms of contributing to the creation of them as well as the use of them. So like right now, if you wanted to kind of contribute to make cloud infrastructure more powerful for specific industries that you care about and problems that you care about, you know, there are a lot of different places where you can contribute that code and it ends up upstream, whether it ends up in OpenStack where you know, millions of people around the world, you know, rely on services powered OpenStack, or you contribute to Kubernetes or Ceph, you know, any of these fundamental building blocks, you're helping to kind of contribute to and have a say and really a seat at the table in how those tools, what they actually do. Does that make sense?
It does completely. And this is going to lead into something that I've said a lot to people. And sometimes people take it the wrong way. And I always say, well, you have to realize that anything cloud related is a commodity, right? Mm-hmm. Like, regardless if you buy your cloud from, you know, the huge software vendor that I work at, or the bookstore, or the search engine, or the people that sell physical servers to, or if you get it bespoke from somewhere else, or if in your situation you're able to leverage the work of a bunch of other individuals to have it, it's a commodity. Last time I checked, the servers at one vendor are usually the same configurable wise as a different vendor. Price might be different, might be some subtle configuration differences, but it's still, you know, like the six components that put together a server, right? Like, and it goes to me like this thing that I've had recently, this thought of like computing as being, like we talk about basic human rights, right? And I talk about this whole concept about, you know, how computing should be a basic human right. Like, you should have access to computing, whether it be cell phone service or wireless internet service or the ability to do whatever, right? These things are, like, especially now, like, that people can't leave their house because of weather or because of pandemics or whatever. People are far more dependent on technology. So whenever I hear of an organization or anything that says, oh, like, no, like, this is like a privilege for people. It's like, well, no, it's not really a privilege because everybody's dependent on it. Like, you wouldn't take
a necessity.
Yeah.
I would say it's absolutely a necessity for functioning and being a part of society in this day and age.
Yeah, I growing up, I lived in a very rural area, and I remember when we first got dial-up modem, 28K, right? I remember, like, the first time it took, like, 45 minutes to load, like, the Yahoo homepage. Like, I remember, and at that point in time, I was like, why did we just get this? And I asked my dad, like, why did we just get this? And he's like, well, it wasn't available. Like, well, why wasn't it available? And he had no good answer because, like, no one has a good answer when a dumb teenager is asking a question like that. But it's very spot on. Like, there's people in the part of the world that just don't have access to technology solely because of their status, you know, in whether where they live or, you know, in what communities they are in. It's just, I see there's tons of opportunity to be able to make that not a thing. And you see companies that are trying to do it, like you see Elon Musk with Starlink and things like that, right, where they're trying to make technology more broadly available. And one of the things that, and the reason why I'm ranting about this again is I'm talking about open infrastructure, right? This concept of you don't need to go somewhere to get compute resources, right? You really don't have to. The vendors of the world, one of them being my employer, makes the ease of access substantially so smaller, the barrier to entry substantially smaller. So, you know, somebody who works at Microsoft like me, and obviously I'm very well aware of all the great things that our cloud provides, can you just give me like a couple of minutes about what the value proposition is for why we would want to use open infrastructure?
Yeah, so a couple of things I want to mention. One is just a specific open source project that's quite new and just forming up now called Magma. This is magmacore.org is a website. You can go learn more about it. But this is specifically a mobile packet core. It's an essential component within mobile networks. And it is actually being deployed right now through a nonprofit called MuralNet around North America to help connect indigenous communities that have had, you know, very, very poor access to connectivity, especially in the past year with pandemic, people being stuck at home. So Magma actually has a mission to connect the billion people on planet Earth that are currently, you know, not connected or unconnected to mobile networks. And so that's the very specific technology and the big stack of bits that you need to run a mobile network. They're helping kind of drive down the cost, increase accessibility. It's also being deployed around the world in Southeast Asia, Africa, Latin America, you know, throughout various countries in South America. So that's just one building block that's relatively new that I'm personally very excited about. I think it's going to help with that end goal that you talked about. So people in rural areas and in just countries that haven't had the best access to technology. But to get to your question about sort of like just cloud computing in general and sort of infrastructure as a service, you know, that the open infrastructure angle to that, from my standpoint, Open Infrastructure Foundation, there's a couple of different ways in which something like OpenStack and the other open source components that our communities build, you know, come to play. One is through infrastructure as a service. So there are providers like OVH, Vexos, City Network. There are a bunch of different providers around the world, and they provide infrastructure as a service powered by OpenStack. So that's the same as what you would get from like Azure or AWS or Google, where you swipe a credit card and for, you know, a few cents an hour, whatever, you get compute, storage, and networking. So in that sense, that's, you know, just an alternative to getting it from the, you know, the big three providers, but it happens to be powered by this software that you can download and run yourself if you want to run your own cloud. So the alternative is, you know, downloading that source code and running your own cloud. So you can have a private cloud environment. So if you're somebody like Wells Fargo or Verizon. I mean, those are giant companies that run their own clouds, all the big financial services, but they're also small companies that run it themselves as well. So really it's just kind of because the underlying source code that powers those cloud environments is available, you have the option at any time, even if you're paying someone else to operate for you. If I wanted to suddenly, run it myself, or I want to run a mix of environments, then you have that option, and that gives you that additional freedom. And so that's part of what we mean by open infrastructure and why we think it's really critical.
No, that's great. And I want to just say this before, it's not like an either or, right? Like one of the things that I think that people get very, very tied up about, one of the things that I have the benefit of doing at Microsoft is I get to talk to Microsoft customers all the time. And the number one question I always get asked is why Azure? Why Azure versus AWS versus GCP versus whatever. And I get into this rant, and I apologize before I start the rant because, some people don't take it very well. It's do you need just one? One of the things that's very important is that you want to have, when we talk about investing in with money, right? You want diversification. Just because you are very tied into a particular concept from a company doesn't mean that you can't diversify your intellectual property across many different companies, right? It's all to your benefit, right? The idea of hybrid cloud is, people talk about it all the time, but it's very much like you're just diversifying your technology portfolio, right? And I think a lot of people probably don't look at the alternatives of, what if I decided to just spin up my own infrastructure as a service, right? I build out, I have a data center already because every big company has a data center, or at least they did 10 years ago. So what if I took some of that space and turned it into something that I could use for myself, share with my customers or my partners, and build something that's a bit more scalable, right? And then I can merge that with what I'm doing with the other public clouds. And then I have this concept that I'm diversifying things not just across public entities, but entities that I own myself, right? I think that that's extremely interesting. And I think one of the things that as going through some of the open infrastructure statements and looking at what OpenStack is doing, it's enabling people to not have to build it themselves, right? I think 20 years ago, everybody had to have a whole flight of database administrators and a whole flight of sys administrators whose sole job it was to manage patching for VMs or manage SAN usage for VMs and all these other things. And what OpenStack or OpenInfra provides is just gateways to not have to do all that work, which goes back to what we're saying about open source in general, standing on the shoulders of people that are way smarter than you probably, which is a good thing.
Yeah, I think what it ultimately provides is options. So it's not overly restrictive in saying that you have to go to this one company or there's only this one model. If you look at the people who do choose to have their own data centers, run their own clouds, most of them, the vast majority of them, do that with OpenStack. But almost all those companies also have an account with Microsoft Azure, and I think one of the easiest tropes in tech writing, on a slight rant here, which is everything is a zero-sum game. Everything is this going to win or that going to win? Guess what? It's almost always not a zero-sum game. I mean, very rarely do these things end up with one winner. And so that whole narrative is just kind of broken, and it makes an easy clickbait headline. But the reality is, open source generally, I think, has led to people having more choices, not less. And obviously, that could change. If we wake up tomorrow and the only place anywhere in the world you can consume open source or consume cloud computing at all is with one company called Amazon, that wouldn't be a good outcome, in my opinion.
My job would be substantially less exciting. Sorry, interrupting. Keep going.
No. Yeah, my job would be less interesting. A lot of people would have less interesting circumstances. So people that worry about that, I kind of say, that is a that is an outcome that would be, in my opinion, not a great outcome. However, I don't really see evidence that we're there today. I feel like there's more ways you can build and consume infrastructure than ever. There's more economic opportunity to write code and contribute it upstream than ever. So, you know, I don't necessarily think that that, you know, we're in a state right now where we're on the precipice of kind of like having no choices in how to consume infrastructure.
I mean,
the Open Infrastructure Foundation, which has this mission to give people more choices, we just announced we have more platinum members than we've ever had. We have more companies getting involved than we've ever had. So, you know, I'm not going to cry wolf and say like that the sky is falling. I would say that like things are pretty good in open source infrastructure land. And so, you know, come on in, the water's fine.
Yeah, I mean, and it one of the things too that I think it's very exciting is, you know, this concept of, you know, infrastructure as code has also like completely like decreased the barrier to entry for a lot of folks too, right? Where in like I said in the past, managing physical hardware or managing like screens, you know, when you're managing a hardware, like if you're not an expert, you're gonna have a hard time. But being able to enable the provisioning of environments in a very straightforward way, like complete game changers as it pertains to making infrastructure in general accessible to people. Because as somebody who's been a developer my entire professional career, like whenever I was asked to like go in and like do something in IIS, I was like, okay, am I gonna do it? Am I gonna do it right this time, or am I gonna break this website every single time? And you know, being able to build out things in an automated way. So the idea, obviously. And for people that don't know, like you can get the source code for like all of this stuff that Mark's talking about on their website, right? So like you can easily like just go and say, oh, I want to host my own infrastructure as a server compute VMs, right? You can download the source code for that. It'll come with infrastructure as code components, and then it's literally just, it's obviously not as easy as right click run, but it's a concept that's a far more approachable than it was in the past.
Yeah, and I'm glad you mentioned, because I haven't really been plugging all of our projects and
please do
stuff, but you know, openinfra.dev is the homepage for our foundation, and from there you can see all the projects we support, including OpenStack, which is openstack.org. But you know, if you go to openinfra.dev, there's links out to all the different communities, and you can join them, or you can go to openinfra.dev/join and join the foundation. It's free for individual members, or you know, companies can join and be part of it and kind of, you know, help fund the work that we do for all the people around the world. We have 110,000 members now in over 180 countries, so it's extremely global. It's extremely powerful force for bringing people together. My humble opinion. And so I think. You know, that is our mission, and you know, we're trying to build more of that software. And to your point about, you can download the source code and you can run it. It's also just available as products, which are themselves open source. So Red Hat OpenStack is an OpenStack distribution. You know, Canonical has Ubuntu OpenStack. Mirantis, I'm going to get in trouble because I won't be able to name them all. But it's okay.
You have a website for that.
Yeah, and actually on the openstack.org website, there's a marketplace which has all the distributions. So, you know, if it seems daunting to go download source code, you know, compile it, you know, if that sounds too much for you, it probably is, you know, but there are commercial products, varying types. So there's a whole ecosystem of companies that take the software, they contribute to it, and then turn around and package it and then support it for people in the market. So it's not always just kind of a do-it-yourself world. You have that option. This is the thing. It's all about options for me. Like people can get down to and look at every single line of source code in the entire stack. It's millions of lines of code. 8,000 developers or more have contributed to OpenStack since we started it. It's one of the three most active open source projects in the world today, even after 10 years, which is kind of mind blowing. A lot of people, you know, kind of will be surprised to hear that probably, but you know, it's crazy. We have thousands of developers, you know, all over the world, and it's just an awesome thing. And one of the things that I love about it is that connecting across countries. You know, I've gotten to meet people in Korea and Japan and China and, you know, Israel. And I mean, every country that you can imagine, there's somebody that's getting involved in open source through OpenStack. And that's just been an amazing thing for me to have that experience, and everyone who joins the community can have that same experience. You can get to know people on the other side of the planet and solve problems with them. I mean, that's a lot more fun probably than a lot of other lines of work. So I highly recommend it for that reason alone.
Yeah. And I think, you know, as we're wrapping up, I think it's really important to call out that it's of a similar vein to if you want to get an NPM package, or if you want, like, these things are all equatable, right? I think a lot of people, they see infrastructure, like I even mentioned earlier, like the concept of managing infrastructure can be very daunting, right?
Yes.
But at the end of the day, also, like, have you ever actually, you know, looked at, like, when you install an NPM package, what it actually does? Like, that in and itself is very daunting, right? Like, yeah. It requires, like, a whole nother piece of software to actually, like, do all the stuff. And if you look at the logs, it's like, okay, there's no way I could do anything like this. And I think it's one of those things where there's obfuscation is very important in this case, right? You're obfuscating a lot of the challenging components and just opening up access. First off, if you want access to everything, here it is, have fun. Or if you need just this little itty bitty piece, you need to know the understanding of this little itty bitty piece, that's all you need. That's all you really care about. And that's
there are layers of abstraction, I think, is you know, part of the concept you're talking about is like, yeah, let's take advantage of these abstraction layers. But what's cool about it is, to your point earlier about if you're the type of person that likes to take apart a remote control car, you can do that. Like, you can take advantage of it fully assembled and use it. You can also take it apart and see how it operates. And so you can kind of have it either way, or just satisfy your curiosity and see how does a public cloud work. Well, you can actually find out by looking at the source code and tinkering with it. And you can learn a lot from tinkering.
Oh, for sure. I mean, as somebody who took apart the family computer the day two, like it came home day two, it was in pieces. My dad said, "You better fix this," and I said, "Okay." And it took me a few days, but I figured it out. I mean, I was in trouble, but I mean, I learned something, right? And I think that's really the goal of all open source, is that we have the opportunity to learn things from people that are, you know, I wouldn't say maybe smarter than us or not, but have far more passion about things. Because from what I've seen is that if you're very passionate about something, your ability to drill down where other people don't have as much interest, it's substantial. So as we wrap up, Mark, I want to thank you so much for being on the stream. Like, this was super fun. I love talking about open source. I don't get very many opportunities to talk to people that come at open source from a different angle. Like, you definitely have come, you have a technology background, obviously, but from the business planning standpoint, from the marketing standpoint, like it's always a great conversation to talk with people that aren't just like, well, let me just talk about like the really deep inner workings of how some technology works, right? Like, that's fun too, but talking about business with people is also really fun. So I want to thank you so much for being on the stream. When we finish up our chats, one of the things that I love to ask our guests, if they can describe open source or how they feel about open source in one word, what would that word be? Do you have an example? Not to put you on the spot.
Oh, man. Yeah, you did put me on the spot. What one word to describe open source?
It could be multiple words. I'm not gonna tax you on it.
I'm going to go with opportunity.
Yeah. That's great too. One of the things that people, like, I've gotten community or collaboration a lot, which is, I think, very fair. Opportunity as well. You know, our conversation went from, you know, from a business standpoint, opportunity, from rights or openness. You know, these things, the opportunity, open source opens up many doors, not just for technologists, but for people who are users of technology too, which I think is very important.
Yeah, some of those are probably better answers. Community, I probably
I like opportunity.
I'm pitching my angle.
I like opportunity because opportunity.
About, like, just get involved.
Yeah, opportunity is very direct to you, and that's all that matters. So, again, thank you so much, Mark, for being on the show. If anybody wants to learn more about Mark and what he's doing, Sparky Collier is his Twitter handle. And then in the chat, I posted openstack.org, openinfra.dev, some of the other things that he's doing. And I think one of the things that's really exciting about chatting with folks like you, Mark, is that you just bring passion to the table. And I want to thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Awesome. Well, thank you again, everybody, for tuning in. And this will go up on YouTube later today. Enjoy the rest of your day. Take care.